K-Mud Podcast presents.
Good morning, and welcome to Heart of the Earth. This is a program about Native Americans and other Indigenous cultures. My name is Agnes, and I opened with Young Spirit, Red Rock Woman from their Angel Eagle CD. And yes, it's March, it's Women's History Month, so I have, but before I get into the woman's stories I'm going to read today, I just want to mention, you know, last Friday was this Pisces party, and I chose to go to that instead of Too Short. And, you know, when they start talking about the Sinkyone Wilderness, the Sinkyone, you know, it's named after the last Indigenous peoples of that area. And when they talk about Sally Bell, she was the last living Sinkyone Indian. And she's buried at Four Corners, you know, right off of Usal Road. And she survived. I mean, when they came and massacred her people, she ran and hid. And she watched as they, you know, bungled and just beat up her sister and killed her, and they cut out her heart and threw it in the bushes. And she witnessed all that. She was about 8 or 9 years old, and she ran into the forest with her uncle, and they survived for like 3 or 4 months, mainly on eating wild strawberries. And I remember one time hiking there, and I saw some wild strawberries, and I just fell to my knees. I was like, oh my gosh, this is how Sally Bell survived. So, you know, knowing that history and being part of saving the Sinkyone Wilderness, it was just kind of a little hard when you knew you had a couple of people up there, especially one who starts talking about it and was never there, never experienced the Sinkyone Wilderness, you know, when we were trying to save it. And they started mentioning people, and, you know, no Native people were mentioned besides myself. And I know I wasn't a ghost when I was riding that sheriff's car. And I enjoyed that ride in the sheriff's car because whoever got arrested before me put an Earth First sticker in the back seat. So I'm looking at that as I'm being driven out of there. Or, you know, when I was standing at Four Corners directing all the media because I had a baby, so I didn't want to go down. And so I took care of that. And Richard Ginger was doing such incredible work. I mean, the man was phenomenal. He knew every forestry rule and law, and he would tell the politicians. It was just amazing. But, you know, it was like at a stalemate. It wasn't moving very far. It would just, you know, things weren't moving. And then the Native people were involved, and they started doing prayers and ceremonies, and things started happening. And the International Indian Treaty Council, Fred Downing, became part of the lawsuit. And so, you know, when there was no Native names being mentioned in Kingfisher, my gosh, he was the first one that went down there. And he's also the one who showed me how to heal the tree, because Lon Mulvaney, whose name I threw out there, and they finally said his name, he was the one that stood between the chainsaws and the loggers as they were trying to cut down the Sally Bell Grove. And that tree there, it took like 14, 15 people with our arms stretched out wide to encircle that whole tree. That's how big it is. But when they cut, you know, a big wedge about a third of the way into it, you know, Lon stopped them. The loggers finally had to leave, or else they were going to have to, you know, chainsaw him, and he wasn't going to let that happen. And I remember Kingfish, I went down there one time, and he told me what to do to make it heal. And so I put the word out, and six women showed up. And Arlo Hagler, the late Arlo Hagler, in his old light green old van. And we all went out there, and we spent, oh my gosh, the whole day, you know, and a brigade, you know, moving all this creek mud and everything. And now when you go there, you can't even, it all grew back, just like Kingfisher said it would. And you can't even see where it was cut into. So, you know, I finally just stood up and said, hey, you know, there's Native people involved. And then Richard, of course, you know, started mentioning Bill Wapapon, John Trudell, and I think Carl Dalton, Kingfisher, Tony Gonzalez. And for me, I will never forget when we had a hearing in Ukiah early on, and I got up and spoke. And then later on, this young Native woman who I'd never seen before got up and spoke, and she just brought me to tears. I was so moved by her, and I said, boy, I want to know this woman. But I never saw her afterwards, but I realized that she had come with Ricardo Tapia for International Indian Treaty Council. And the next day when I was home in my cabin out of the Mattole River, Ricardo pulled up, and he had that young girl with her because she wanted to meet me, and I guess he knew I wanted to meet her. And that's how I met Louise Benally from Big Mountain, and the rest is history. So I just wanted to tell a little history that, you know, didn't want to get spoken about. I don't know. I know when we finally were able to secure it, but what were they going to do with it? And they had a hearing out in Fort Bragg. I remember Judy Berry was there. This was after the bombing. And Fred Coyote Downing, the Wailaki elder, he got up and spoke, and this was after, you know, this Coastal Conservancy panel. They went on with all their charts and went on and on and on, and then, you know, it was time to speak, you know, time to have the people speak, and Fred was being very direct and slow to make sure his words were understood. And one of the women on the coastal, she goes, could you just speed it up? You know, you're going a little slow here. And I oh my gosh. And so two or three people later, it was my turn to speak. And I had this whole prepared speech, and I got about a minute into it, and I just stopped. And I said, I'm sorry, man, I'm hurting. I'm hurting for the way you just treated my elder. I said, we had to listen to you speak on and on and on, option A, option B, option C. And then you tell the elder whose land this is to speed it up? And then I told him, I said, you know, there's one option that's missing here. And this is, you know, probably 40 years ago, 45 years ago. And I said, you need to give it back to the people you stole it from. And this is way before the land back movement started, but that's what was in my heart. Give the land back. And there was an African-American on that Coastal Conservancy board, and he said, hey, maybe we should sell it to him for a dollar. And then by the time it was all said and done, they said, okay, well, if you can come up with $2 million, you know, it'll become the Intertribal Sinkyon Park. And that $2 million was raised. I believe part of it came from the Landman Foundation. And so that's just a little history of the Sinkyon that I wanted to share with all of you that, I don't know, after, you know, the names were being, you know, omitted and stuff, I just left. I not wanted to hear Francine sing. I just felt better leaving. I want to share this with you. It's from Levi Rickett of Native News Online. And it talks about Cesar Chavez because, the shock of learning about all, you know, being a sexual predator and Dolores Huerta and how, you know, she knew for the movement's sake she had to keep quiet and the sacrifices were made by so many women. But this is what he says. If Chavez's name comes down, so must Columbus. Because in March of 2000, two friends and I were driving back to Grand Rapids from the east side of Michigan, where we had attended a birthday event honoring Cesar Chavez. Somewhere along that drive in the middle of the night, a simple but powerful idea took hold. Our city should honor his legacy by naming a street after him. Within a week, we formed a committee and submitted a proposal to the city of Grand Rapids to rename Granville Avenue, a road that runs through one of the most vibrant and concentrated Hispanic communities in the city. We quickly learned that naming a street is never simple. Part of Granville Avenue was a state truck line, which meant we needed approval not only from the city, but from the state of Michigan as well. It took persistence, organization, and belief, but after meeting every requirement, the effort succeeded, and the street was renamed Cesar E. Chavez Avenue. And our work didn't stop there. We pushed for the renaming of Hall Elementary School in his honor. We established a scholarship fund bearing his name, one that, over time, has raised more than $1 million to support Hispanic students pursuing their secondary education. And each of these efforts was rooted in a shared purpose, to recognize Chavez's long life fight to secure dignity, fair wages, and humane working conditions for the farm workers who plant and harvest the food that sustains us, workers who remain among the most overlooked in American society. 2 years ago, I attended an art event hosted by Olympic gold medalist Billy Mills in downtown Sacramento Park. It was pouring rain, but when I learned there was a statue honoring Chavez nearby, I walked over to see it. I remember standing there in the rain, reflecting on his legacy and what it meant, not just to history, but to people like me who had tried in our own way to carry it forward. Then this past Wednesday came. I was in Washington, D.C., attending a hearing for Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, Republican of Oklahoma, to become the Secretary of Department of the Homeland Security when I received a text message. It described deeply disturbing allegations of sexual misconduct involving Chavez and minors. I sat there stunned. Disbelief gave way to a need to understand. I read the New York Times article referenced in the message. Then I read the statement from Dolores Huerta, who co-founded the United Farm Workers Union with Chavez. Now 96 years old, she alleged that Chavez raped her twice, saying she had remained silent for more than 60 years to protect the movement they built together. In that moment, everything shifted. Within 24 hours, the reputation of a civil rights icon was shaken to its core. Calls emerged to remove his name from public spaces. For many of us who had spent years, decades, fighting for justice and lifting up his legacy, it felt like the ground had given way beneath our feet. My emotions were not simple. They were tangled, heavy, unresolved. I know this much. Had I known then what has now been alleged, I would have not taken part in the effort to honor him in 2000. That truth sits with me. And yet another truth sits alongside it. I felt a deep unease watching how quickly a Mexican-American civil rights leader's legacy was dismantled in the public square. It forced me to think about how this country chooses which histories to confront and which to leave standing. Consider Christopher Columbus. For many indigenous communities and historians, he is not a hero, but a symbol of brutality and colonization. His arrival in the Americas set off a wave of violence against the Taíno people, marked by enslavement, forced labor, torture, and impossible demands for gold. Historical accounts also document acts of sexual violence committed by his men against indigenous women, part of a broader system of dehumanization that devastated entire populations and shaped centuries of oppression. If we are to reckon honestly with history, we cannot be selective. We cannot hold one figure accountable while ignoring another whose actions led to widespread suffering. If Chavez's name is to be removed from public places, then the same standard must be applied elsewhere. The names, symbols, and holidays tied to Columbus deserve that scrutiny. Oh, so should all those places that Trump keeps putting his name on. But to continue. And while we are confronting hard truths, accountability cannot stop with history. It must extend into the present. Whenever abuse of power and exploitation exist, regardless of politics or status, I'm referring, yes, the Epstein files. As one of the original members of the committee that worked to honor Cesar Chavez in Grand Rapids, I now believe his name should be removed from the street and the school. The scholarship fund that has helped so many students should continue, but under a new name that reflects the values it was meant to uphold. I also find myself in agreement with the statement released by Chavez's family. Quote, as a family steeped in the values of equity and justice, we honor the voices of those who feel unheard and who report sexual misconduct. These allegations are deeply painful to our family. They are painful for many of us. But for those of us committed to the struggle for justice, this moment cuts deep. But it also reminds us of something essential. No movement is defined by a single person. The work, the fight for dignity, equity, and truth is bigger than any one individual, and it must go on. And Dolores Huerta was raped twice by Cesar Chavez, and she bore two children, which she let other families raise. She's just such an incredible woman that I want to share a strong woman's song with you. Whoa!
Ah!
And that is the Odwin Kwe Singers giving us a strong woman song from their CD, New Moon Medicine. And just one more story I wanted to share about the Sinkyon, because my daughter is attending Fire Creek School. There was a lot of people in Edisburg that were involved, just not the people out in the Gulch. And we did a field trip down to Bear Harbor, and then we were going to walk into the Sinkyon with the kids. And this is when you could drive all the way to Bear Harbor, but some cars could make it. And my little Volkswagen Bug did. And so at the end of the day when we were leaving, I got in the car, and I believe it was Peter Powell who was with me in the car. And then three children in the back, my little Bug. And as we're driving up, we start to drive, and we leave the beach, and we start driving up. Out of nowhere, this puma just comes, starts just running and along next to my car. I'm just moving slow, and it's just prancing right next to us. This went on, for quite a while. I mean, the kids, you know, also, I mean, we were being escorted out of the Sinkyon by a puma lion. It was amazing. And then 2 days later, there was a hearing at the old vets hall for the Sinkyon, and all the kids from Fire Creek, and I have to say, I don't remember any other children, just the children from Fire Creek that came. And they carried a sign, and they put an O instead of an I when they were writing wilderness. So it said, save the worldliness. And they all got up and spoke, and it was just very moving. And it's really important that we share, you know, this history with our children, and we share, you know, the earth with the children, because, my gosh, when I think of the future and the future of Mother Earth, boy, more than ever, we really need to share with our children. I'm going to share with you now, it'll probably take me close to the end of the hour, read the introduction to Crystal Wapapa's book, A Feather and a Fork, 125 Intertribal Dishes from an Indigenous Food Warrior. And I've known Crystal many, many years. I remember about 20 years ago at a ceremony, and we were talking, we were changing our clothes, and she was talking about how she'd catered that day. She was really getting into all her cooking, and she started off catering, and she brought all the leftovers from her catering, and there were some purple potatoes and other things. And I'm just so, so proud of this woman who grew up in Oakland, and she tells her story, and it's so beautiful that I thought I would just share it with you. And she says, when most people, and I also want to mention that she's doing a book tour, because this book just came out on March 17th. On Thursday, April 9th, she's going to be at the Cal Poly Food Sovereignty Lab. It's being sponsored by Northtown Books. And so again, that's up at Cal Poly on April 9th at 2 p.m. in the afternoon. All right. She says, when most people picture Native Americans, the image they conjure is a relic of the past, stoic warriors and noble Indians in cowboy films. The stereotypical portrayals of Native peoples are grounded in a history of poverty on reservations. Rarely does the broader public acknowledge the modern reality of Native Americans, particularly of those growing up in places like Oakland, California, an inner city far from an idyllic past. The experience of being Native is not defined by the imagery of a vanishing people, but by the vibrant, complex lives lived within contemporary society, navigating not only Native American identity, but also the challenges of urban life. It is the same with our food. My restaurant, Wapapa's Kitchen, sits near the intersection of Avenida de la Fuente and 12th Street in Oakland's Fruitvale Transit Village. I was born near here and lived in apartments with my mom and younger sisters off International Boulevard. I attended Lazier Elementary, now Lazier Charter Academy, on 29th Street, and for a time we lived communally in the American Indian Movement, the AIM Freedom and Survival House, at 8th and 27th Streets. I met my best friend, Yvette, there when she would visit her father, who was close friends with my uncle, Bill Wapapa. Our families knew one another before Yvette and I were even born. We attended what was called survival school, led by my uncle. We learned the multiplication tables and played educational games, like chess. We attended sunrise ceremonies, and the Oakland Fire Department kept extinguishing the fires we lit as part of those ceremonies because they did not understand that the fires were sacred to us. If we were sick, we went to the Native American Health Center. If we were hungry, we received food at the International Friendship House. Fruitvale, this community, means a lot to me. From the big orchard windows and the outdoor patio at the entrance of Wapapa's kitchen, I can see thousands of commuters coming and going daily from the BART station, the one where Oscar Grant III was shot and killed by transit police in 2009. The brilliant blue mural honoring his short life was painted on the west side of the station. And although out of my view, the mural is a reminder to even those passing through that he mattered. The train tracks are held up by concrete pillars covered in murals of corn, cottontails, hibiscus, cactus, and a hummingbird eye, all sacred symbols within the indigenous cultures of the Americas. They represent longevity, sustenance, health, resilience, and strength. Many days, local farmers sell freshly picked produce beneath the shade of the tracks to residents and workers in the area and to students who attend Arise High School just above the restaurant. The walls of Wapapa's kitchen, too, are covered with murals. The columns, painted by New Mexico Diné artist Tony Abeta, illustrate the centuries-old foundations of my people's food. A wall was designed and painted by a collective of New Mexico-based Native American artists known as the NSRGNTS. The artwork pays homage to the pre-colonial indigenous foods that we serve in the restaurant. On the left, an Incan man carries the potatoes of Peru alongside a Mayan woman offering maize from Mexico. On the right, a Lakota Sioux presents bison as an Ohlone woman bears a basket of acorns. They are all dressed in traditional tribal attire and are walking toward the center, where a Kickapoo woman, who represents my heritage, wears a purple ribbon dress and holds a native squash. The vivid colors evoke the dark red of a South Dakota chokecherry, the deep blue of Ute Mountain corn, the burnished gold of Zia Mayas, and a shade of orange that matches the flesh of a Buffalo Creek squash. Among my staff and me, there are 16 different tribes represented. On a banner across the top of the mural are the words, Indigenous Food Warriors. That sums up who we are. The canary yellow shelves of my indigenous food pantry are in full view of our guests and are lined with jars filled with heirloom seeds that must have been gifted to me from other tribes. Seneca white corn, blue corn, Lakota popcorn, Pueblo hominy, Pawnee roasted hominy, Kickapoo corn from my Oklahoma family, cracked corn, flint corn, Hubbard squash, and chokecherries from the lower Butte, the Paiute, and Montana. I want our guests to make the connection between what is on their plates and the bounty of our nation's original foods represented on these shelves. These seeds are very much alive to me, as they each have their own personalities. I talk to them. I pray over them before I plant or cook with them. They are so beautiful, and I have a sacred responsibility to care for them just as I do the people who come to eat. Many of my neighbors who live in the surrounding community speak Spanish as their first language, but you will hear conversations in Arabic, Farsi, Wolof, and Japanese, among others. We are all striving to make a living, to be seen and heard, and I know how hard it is to not disappear, to be represented, to wonder where my next meal is coming from, to feel the weight of intergenerational trauma, to lose someone to addiction or preventable disease. No matter what goes on outside my walls, Wapapa's kitchen is a place for healing. Food, after all, is medicine. Food is community. Oakland is home to some 18,000 Native Americans, many of whom descend from the Native Americans relocated to California's East Bay after World War II, when the U.S. government simultaneously realized that the lands it forcibly removed tribes to during the 1800s held untapped reserves of oil and other minerals, and that the cost of maintaining those reservations, however sparse, was too high. So the Indian Relocation Acts of 1952 and 1956, the federal government offered the promise of jobs and housing, the American dream, while revoking the status of more than 100 recognized Native American tribes, so that the land on which they had lived and that they had tended was no longer theirs. Oakland, Ohlone land for thousands of years before the arrival of the Spanish, was identified by the Bureau of Indian Affairs as one of seven hubs of American Indian relocation and assimilation into mainstream American life. The only problem was that most of those who relocated arrived with nothing more than a few clothes and a used bus ticket. There was no welcome center. She says, I am an enrolled member of the Kickapoo tribe of Oklahoma, the first in my family to be born in Oakland. My grandmother was 13 when she had her first child with Fred Wapapa. By the time my grandmother was 27 years old, she was a divorced single mother raising six kids on the Saxon Fox Reservation in Oklahoma. There was a 14-year difference between her first child, my Uncle Fred, and the youngest, my mother Beverly. My grandmother later married Eugene Makasea, a friend who grew up on the Kickapoo Reservation in McLeod, Oklahoma. Eugene is who I knew as my grandfather. He served in the U.S. Navy and was stationed in Los Angeles. They were relocated to Alameda, just west of Oakland, where my mother and her siblings were raised. In the novel There, There, author Tommy Orange wrote, quote, look no further than your last name. Follow it back. You might find your line paved with gold or beset with traps. Kickapoo is the Algonquin language from which the tribe and its band comes means he who moves here and there. I guess we were destined to wander. But in the Kickapoo language, Wapapa means entices enemy to ambush. We Wapapas like to stir the pot in our communities. My grandparents and my mother's older siblings endured the boarding schools that stripped them of their families, their names, their languages, and their dignity to eradicate the Indian inside of them. The abuse and shame that resulted from these experiences, coupled with relocation, often left them rudderless and seeking solace in substances like alcohol. Uncle Bill struggled with alcohol and relationships before settling into himself in the late 1960s. His younger sister, my aunt Carletta Billy, worked as a clerk with the Bureau of Indian Affairs at the time, and she encouraged him to get involved. He became a leader in the American Indian movement. In 1975, he was one of the co-founders of the Indigenous People's Day Alcatraz Sunrise Gathering when he served as a leader within the International Indian Treaty Council, a body that represented 99 distinct tribes. He led 30,000 people on a walk across from Alcatraz to Washington, D.C. to protest anti-Indian bills working their way through Congress that would further diminish treaty rights. And because of what was dubbed the longest walk, both the Indian Child Welfare Act and the American Indian Religious Freedom Act were signed into law. Aunt Carletta was part of the Indians of All Tribes movement that occupied Alcatraz between 1969 and 1971. My younger sister, Mercedes, and I were born into the world of activism. 10 years later, another sister was born. We had different fathers, and the family moved frequently, often living with other relatives and friends, adopted aunties, as my mother grappled with financial insecurity, mental illness, and alcoholism. By the time I was 11, we had lived with aunts and uncles throughout the United States and Canada. I can only imagine the conversations among family members. quote, "Who's going to take Beverly's children this time?" But they kept us in the family, no matter whether they could afford to feed us. They put community first, and that community shaped who I am. One aunt taught me how to forge, another how to feed an army with grace. We lived for a time on the Hoopa Valley Reservation in Northern California, between my Aunt Teresa Ballinger's home and my Aunt Carletta's place. They both let me work alongside them in the kitchen, even when I was little. Aunt Carletta taught me how to make pies and sauces from the berries I picked, and Aunt Teresa taught me everything I know about hospitality. No one's glass was ever half full. It was always full. At school, I was the new girl in kindergarten, and the kids kept talking about that black girl. I looked around to see who they were talking about and realized they were talking about me. I never knew my father, an African-American man from the Texas Hill Country, but being mixed race made me different. I was the only African-American in our large extended family. Yet my native family loved and cared for me. My Uncle Bill taught me to be proud of who I am, all the different parts it made me, and I have to say Bill Wapapa did the same with me. He heard me speaking about Mother Earth, and while the Treaty Council was working on treaty rights, he knew how important that was going to be. And he took me under his wings, and I traveled all over the world on behalf of the International Treaty Council. I was in Japan. I was sent to Asia, all different places, Ecuador. I was so happy to go home. So, yes, I have so much to thank Bill Wapapa for myself. But to continue, he gave me books by Alice Walker, a friend of his from the Bay Area, and he taught me to be proud of both my black and my Native American heritage. Being both Native and black has given me strength from the ancestors because of where we came from and because of the difficulties we faced through forced displacement. On those frigid journeys crossing the bay to celebrate the annual gatherings on Alcatraz, the clothes, the colors, the passion in the voices calling for recognition, dignity, and basic human rights, my extended family and their friends talked about Indian housing, Indian health care, erasure, education, everything. And during the meals at La Peña Cultural Center afterwards, I always wondered, where were our foods? Why were our foods never on menus or served in restaurants? How was it that a city like Oakland, home of tens of thousands of Native Americans, had no place that served my grandfather's corn soup? By then, my grandparents had returned to Shawnee, Oklahoma, when I visited them during the summers. My grandfather would take me berry picking even when I was barely big enough to carry a basket. I considered the sweet, plump, deep purple blackberries as my friends. I listened to them, talked to them, or when things were rough at home, I would escape to the brambles and find my center among the berries. I think I understood even then that food was a gateway to my happiness, to my truest self. My grandmother and her sister, Aunt Pearl Rolette, taught me how to cut and dry corn in the hot sun for sweet corn soup. That soup is a comfort food to this day. She served it with fry bread, which was a treat, even though it was also an emblem of our colonized food ways. At my grandparents' house, we ate fry bread or biscuits and gravy 3 or 4 times a week. I think even at that young age, though, I already understood there was a big difference between the food that came in a commodity box, white flour, canned vegetables, blocks of bright yellow government cheese, and the food I learned to forage the way the ancestors had. Commodity ingredients represent convenience and industry, meant to make things cheap and easy, but they did not honor creation. Those boxes were just another tactic to separate us from ourselves, just like the boarding schools. But for starving Indian families on reservations who had been displaced from their seeds and their rivers and woods, those boxes held what was sometimes called survival foods. But in the end, those foods are what killed them. My grandmother, grandfather, Uncle Bill, and other family members all developed diabetes. My aunt's leg was amputated. My grandfather's toe was amputated. My sister died of cancer. So many of these diseases could have been prevented had we found our way to the colorful, beautiful, delicious foods of our ancestors who called on us to pay attention to our food, how it is grown, and how it is prepared. For 3 or 4 years during childhood, I also lived with Janella LaRose, a Shoshone Bangkok Carrizo native who met my mother at the AIM House in Oakland. Native people from all over the country lived there and were part of the larger political protest efforts to reclaim their lands, cultures, and religious traditions. They rallied against the Bureau of Indian Affairs and entrenched policies that led to high unemployment, slum living conditions, chronic physical and mental illnesses, and persistent poverty among rural and urban Native Americans. The AIM House offered a communal experience, and I was often in the kitchen right beside Janella, my adopted auntie, cooking for 30 kids and as many adults at night. I was 7 years old, so it was only natural that I would grow up to feed my community. And I want to interject here, because one of the things that Bill Wapapa did was he took me under his wings. He drove me all over Oakland, and he pointed out the AIM House, and he showed me a Native car repair place. If you need your car fixed, this is where you go. And then we were going down one street, he goes, and this is the street where Janelle, we were just talking about, was upset because Tom LeBlanc didn't want to sweep, and she chased him down the road with the broom, and he goes, right here, this is where he was, and he was laughing, and I just was picturing that and had a great laugh. To continue, she says, first, I went to the American Indian College in Phoenix to study business. I had never seen someone who looked like me lead a restaurant, at least not until Loretta Barrett Odin, a citizen Potawatomi, opened the Corn Dance Cafe in Santa Fe, New Mexico in 1993. All along, I worked in restaurants, both in the back and front of house, to make ends meet, even after I married a man I grew up with and gave birth to 3 daughters. For 14 years, my husband and I lived in Shawnee, Oklahoma, near my mother, sister, and cousins, who all had returned to the Kickapoo tribal lands. The Kickapoo can be insular people. One article I read said that anthropologists considered the Kickapoo the least assimilated tribe among the nation's 574 fairly recognized tribes. We are protective because of all that was stolen from us, all that we had to hide to remain Kickapoo. But after 14 years away and with a disintegrating marriage, I missed Oakland and I wanted to go to culinary school. My daughters stayed in Oklahoma with their father to finish school, and I traveled back and forth until they all moved back to Oakland. I enrolled at Le Cordon Bleu in San Francisco from 2008 to 2010, but I did not graduate because I was trying to balance being a full-time student and a mother, and I realized the school could never teach me what I had to learn. I wanted the skills, you know, the ones steeped in French tradition, but there was so much competition. Everyone knew what kind of chef they wanted to be, and they wanted to be the executive chef, not for the love of the food, but for the potential for fame. I stood out the other once again as the one who wanted to bring Native American cuisine to restaurant tables so that we could celebrate a rich and long heritage of honoring the land and waters and what they provided beyond subsistence. I wanted to be the purest, simplest, freshest ingredients like berries and blue corn sing together. When I scoured the Oakland Library for cookbooks by people like me, I couldn't find any until I stumbled on Lois Ellen Frank's Native American Cooking. It was a revelation because I finally had found a book that spoke my language of heirloom, indigenous ingredients. That book and a few others I found inspired me to take the leap to start Wapapa's Kitchen, first as a side hustle to make ends meet, then as a catering business in 2010, cooking out of a commercial kitchen until I could get established. One of my first real catering jobs was the Native American Health Center. Morton Wakazu and Catherine Lewis asked me to cater for 400 people at the Gathering of the Lodges event that focused on sobriety and well-being. I tapped friends from culinary school to help, and we could see as people were eating the corn soup and cornbread that they felt something healing was happening. I saw that some sense of healing happened all across the community as people reconnected with their foods, even when businesses in Silicon Valley, such as Google and Facebook, started to call. I used every event to talk about indigenous foodways, and I cooked with as many ingredients by native growers and producers as I could find. I grew close to the educators and the ethnobotanists at the Cultural Conservancy, a native-led Bay Area nonprofit that, among many things, grows beans, corn, squash, berries, grains, lettuces, stone fruits, and herbs from indigenous seeds gathered and gifted from native communities. We still grow produce for the restaurant at the Culture Conservancy farm at Hare and Shadow. Bonnie Hartley, a member of the Stockbridge Munsee Mohican Nation, was the director of a community services at the Native American Health Club during that time, and she heard about a business incubation program called La Cochina. In 2010, Native American Health offered to sponsor me for the program so that I could connect with mentors like Bill Dickinson, who worked for five-star restaurants and developed the dishes and business that would ultimately become Wapapa's Kitchen. The restaurant grew from a catering business to periodic pop-ups around Oakland and in Fruitvale, where we introduced more people to the striking beauty and pure taste of Native American dishes like blackberry chia pudding and smoked salmon and hibiscus tostadas. The COVID-19 pandemic hit both Native communities and the restaurant industry hard. Catering orders dried up, and the commercial kitchen I had been using in downtown Oakland for years closed. Palestinian-Syrian chef and community activist Reem Asil invited me to host a pop-up dinner at her bakery in the Fruitvale Transit Village in 2020. When she decided to shutter her bakery the following year, Reem asked if I wanted to take over the space. My community surrounded me with support, emotional, spiritual, financial, and in November of 2021, Wapapa's Kitchen opened its doors. It is Oakland's first female indigenous-owned restaurant. The first day the restaurant was open, an older man came in and ordered the blue corn cake. As he ate, he began to cry. He had not been home to his reservation since he was 18 years old, he said, and eating these foods was like leading him home. When he thanked me, I knew, in spite of all my fears of taking on the responsibility of a brick-and-mortar space, that I was on the right road. Everywhere I go, I say the same thing. It is traumatizing for people who are connected to the land to see the land being abused. It is like seeing a member of your family beaten, bruised, and broken. By reconnecting to these foods, we are healing not only our broken bodies, but transforming the generational trauma into strength and regenerating the earth. By sharing our foods, we are helping our neighbors heal as well. This is the reason I have written A Feather and a Fork. Not long ago, some talented students from East Oakland's Fremont High School, many of them indigenous, built garden boxes for the restaurant as part of their arts and culture program. They returned in the rain and helped plant the boxes with edible flowers that also brought greenery and beauty to Fruitvale Village. Afterward, we shared acorn cookies and huckleberry limeade and talked about food sovereignty in our community and what it means to have true access to our foods. When they left the restaurant that day, I prayed that they walked more gently on the land and will, in turn, take better care of it. And I just want to share one more page. Yes, she says, it is important to me that the restaurant, the events we cater, and my advocacy work with different organizations become opportunities to not only teach about Native American foods, but also to take steps toward healing the psychological and emotional wounds that have been carried from one generation to the next. Reclaiming our Native foods is step one toward rebuilding our strength, eradicating nutritional-based diseases, and restoring our vitality. Reclaiming our voice is sacred. At Wapapa's Kitchen, every seasonal dish's name is listed on the menu with both its Kickapoo and English translations. I've done the same with the recipes in this cookbook so that you can see and sound out the lilting musicality of my tribe's native tongue, a language like so many other Native American customs and traditions that almost was lost forever. Each tribal nation speaks a distinct language and holds unique ceremonies, and that is why it is so important to remember and to pass along the culture. And beginning in the late 1800s, the U.S. government began to systematically take Native American children around the age of 5 from their families and send them to Native American boarding schools, which were run like military academies to essentially erase anything Indian. Christian missionaries, Bureau of Indian Affairs instructors, and bureau administrators stripped generations of Native Americans like my grandparents, aunts, and uncles of their given names, cut their hair, punished them for speaking their own languages, humiliated them for wanting to practice their ceremonies, all under the U.S. Department of the Interior's 1883 Code of Indian Offenses and in the guise of assimilating the people who had inhabited this land for millennia into the colonizers' way of life. And not until Congress passed the American Indian Religious Freedom Act in 1978 did Native Americans have the right to freely believe, express, and exercise the traditional religions of the American Indian, Eskimo, Aleut, and Native Hawaiians through ceremonies and spiritual rites. And because of these restrictions that were meant to shame, many indigenous languages and culture traditions remain hidden and were practiced in secret. The elders like my aunts Ruth and Carletta continued to keep and tell the stories and to pass them down. My oldest daughter, Rosario, Big Valley Pomo and Kickapoo, is the language keeper of our family and the benefactor of an elder within the Kickapoo tribe of Oklahoma who has helped identify the words and names of the ingredients so that the Wapapa's Kitchen menu honors the ancestors' memories, sacrifices, and perseverance. And by sharing these words, we keep the language alive and show our gratitude for all who came before. And, I'm going to close with a buffalo song.
has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.